Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Kevin McAleenan, Acting Assistant Commissioner, Office of Field Operations with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Andy Mayner. Kevin, your office has many tools and technologies at its disposal to ensure safe and secure flow of trade and travel. To that end, would you tell us more about the role of the National Targeting Center and the automated targeting system and how they play in your strategy?
Absolutely. The National Targeting Center and the automated targeting system that really enables it is the foundation of that concept of risk segmentation or risk management that's absolutely critical to our effective operations, given the volume of trade and travel we interact with. So we need to have those accurate targeting approaches to focus finite resources on potentially higher risk passengers and cargo. We've got a couple different aspects of how we approach risk assessment from the National Targeting Center. I think the expectation of the American people, and certainly our expectation, is that we must accurately and effectively identify and interdict all potentially known watchlisted threats. So people that our intelligence community, our Department of Defense, our investigative partners have determined might present a risk, we want to make sure we identify their travel and that we take steps to mitigate any potential risk that it poses. The second side is a little bit harder. It's working to find the needles in the haystack that aren't known as threats, to scrutinize risk factors associated with shipments and with travel that might show that they have a greater risk to the United States, and we might need to either inspect them upon arrival, inspect them before they even leave the foreign port of origin, or prevent them from entering the U.S. at all. So in the last 3 years, we've taken an already critical tool for us to the next level and really pushed everything we're doing earlier in the process to increase our zone of security. Many of your listeners will remember Christmas Day 2009 when we had the attempted attack from Farouk Abdulmutallab on a flight into Detroit. And he was an individual who we were set up to put in secondary and interview and potentially deny entry to the United States to upon arrival. We knew he was coming. We were concerned about his potential admissibility. What we learned from that event is we needed to use that capability as early as possible in the process and to take those targeting efforts into the pre-departure environment. And we've done so in coordination with our interagency partners, with our investigative partners at FBI, at ICE, with the Department of State, in a way that's really changed the potential for inadmissible persons who may present a threat to the U.S. Or to the aircraft that they're coming onto the U.S. Before they even board those planes. So in 2009, working with the carriers and our international footprint of what we call our Immigration Advisory Program officers, we prevented boarding for about 450 people that were destined to the U.S. This fiscal year to date, we've already done it for over 4,000 potential travelers. So these are folks that were going to be deemed inadmissible upon arrival, many of whom may have presented some type of security threat, some of which are watchlisted, but others who had other concerns that we were going to address in the old days upon arrival and preventing them from even boarding the aircraft. So that has tremendous security benefits. So another example was the Al-Qaeda in the Iran Peninsula attempted attack with two printer cartridge shipments originating from Yemen. And those cargo shipments in the air environment prior to that event, they wouldn't send information about what's on that plane until about 4 hours prior to arrival. Given the attempted attack, we noted that that plane might not have made it. So inspecting those shipments upon arrival was not going to help address that threat. So we sat down with the private sector in a process that our deputy commissioner has named co-creation and really looked at what could we do together. What point in their supply chain did they have information about that shipment that we could use with our targeting systems to identify a risk and maybe take action before it was ever laden on an aircraft? And in a very rapid process for government and trade to work together, within 6 weeks, we were starting to receive data from the four major express consignment carriers, Federal Express, UPS, DHL, and TNT. And we were able to target those shipments for risk and then give that feedback to the carrier so they could inspect them and mitigate any risk prior to putting them on the aircraft. That's a pilot program that we now have 22 members participating.
Kevin, you've mentioned a lot about Trusted Traveler programs. programs during our show today. Can you talk a little bit more about how you utilize those programs and how you use technology or your vision for using technology to make them more effective as we go forward? Obviously, you've mentioned passenger counts are up, the land border counts are up, bigger planes are now flying into our airports. How do you combine the membership in those with technology?
It's a great question, and the Trusted Traveler efforts are really a key component of our overall approach. We've got three major Trusted Traveler programs, Global Entry in the air environment, Sentry, which is the Southwest Border Land Border Program, and Nexus, which is the program with Canada that applies for both land border traffic and in the preclearance air environment. And you just think of a passenger traveling. They're coming off a 14-hour flight, landing at maybe one of the peak periods at the busy terminals at JFK. And instead of waiting for an hour or more, they can go through processing in just a few minutes because we've taken these steps to work with them up front and do a background check, conduct an interview, and basically do an advanced admissibility determination. You think about the land border environment that you mentioned, Andy, and a daily commuter at San Ysidro, 15 minutes maximum wait time instead of a 90 minutes or more. So it has tremendous benefits, first to that individual, that expediting our trusted and most frequent travelers with 70% faster processing times in the air environment, sometimes even more in the land border environment. Secondly, enhancing security by allowing us to focus on potentially higher risk passengers, get as many folks into the trusted lanes, and we're able to focus our resources effectively on those travelers we know less about. And it also saves significant resources. The equivalent processing savings of dozens of officers annually in each of the environments we're operating in, and lowers costs in other ways too. The Global Entry members, for instance, use an automated kiosk to enter their customs declaration. We don't have to collect that paper form and scan it and store it and maintain it anymore. We can become paperless as we increase our trusted traveler participation. And so we are applying this technology, and the technology we have today is outstanding, and we're going to continue to improve it. But we're using touchscreen kiosks with passport readers, with biometric confirmation capability, and we're continuing to explore improving those user interfaces, using maybe other biometric options such as iris, which are even faster and require less instruction about how to place the fingerprints. So our next step is to try to continue to drive up the number of uses in every environment. We want as many people as possible in these trusted programs. So Global Entry and Nexus and Sentry are going to continue to be central aspects of our strategy. We're continuing to try to get the word out and increase that enrollment. We're up to about 60,000 applications a month, which is tremendous. And we want to continue to grow that exponentially.
Kevin, I'd like to switch gears a bit and talk about infrastructure. And in particular, the existing border crossing infrastructure was built decades ago. And I'd like to understand a little bit more about what your agency is doing to expand and modernize these border crossings.
That is a challenge for us nationally, I think, in a significant way, and an important question. And really part of what's driving those partnerships I talked about, the Beyond the Border and the 21st Century Border. I think the first thing we're doing, going back to our overall strategic priorities, is looking at that transformation piece. How do we use that time and space prior to the individual, the vehicles, the cargo shipments arrival at that constricted port of entry, at that point where there is an infrastructure limitation, as effectively as possible? And that's advanced data, that's securing the supply chain as it approaches the border. That's those concepts we were talking about, like a pre-inspection pilot for clearing a certain commodity or certain type of traffic before it even arrives at the border, so that when it comes through the port of entry, it can speed through really without stopping. The second is really continuing to invest in our technology so that we can move people as quickly as possible. I think a good example of that is what we're calling our pedestrian reengineering efforts. This is now in place in Otay Mesa in the San Diego area and at Paso del Norte in El Paso. And that's just like the ready lane for vehicles. So people with radio frequency identification documents can approach a reader, have their document read very quickly as before they get to the primary booth. And so our officer, before they even step forward, knows who they are, knows if there's any risks or concerns with that individual, and can quickly move to questioning and facilitating that person's arrival. So that the technology application is going to be critical. And so given the limitations in the Federal Buildings Fund budget, which is the fund where our major infrastructure projects come from, and it's been zeroed out the last several years in light of the budget realities we're all facing, I think we need to be innovative and look at the prospects for public-private partnerships, where there's a business case that a group of private sector entities and other investors and state and locals can come together with the federal government to jointly invest in new infrastructure or improving existing infrastructure, staffing it effectively and having the right technology.
Kevin, you talked with a great sense of pride in the beginning about your workforce. How do you, with such a growing workforce with a diversity of missions that includes agriculture, immigration, et cetera, how do you train them? How do you think about training them? And kind of how do you create a culture of leadership and a mentoring culture that takes the agency forward?
That, as I mentioned, is one of our highest priorities. We have a set of initiatives we're calling our leadership engagement initiatives to try to really galvanize that workforce. First, we're looking at how do we train leaders. We're really, really happy with our basic academy and the skill sets it's producing, the esprit de corps and the commitment to mission that our folks are coming out with. We embarked on a multi-year effort to revolutionize that curriculum and learn lessons from the Border Patrol Academy, from some of the military academies, and apply those at the CBP Officer Basic Academy. And we're really pleased with the results. We're also trying to take structural steps to ensure that our managers have that engagement with their front line as part of their core responsibilities and that they identify with that role. It's not just managing people, getting them in booths and putting them in secondary environments and trying to find bad people and dangerous goods. It's about who those people are. What are their skill sets? What are their career aspirations? How do we reach out to them and make them feel good about the organization they're part of? And we're trying to kind of pair up mentors and also create a structure where we have supervisors that are responsible for a certain group of incoming officers in a much more direct way, that they need to touch base with them every pay period. How are they doing mission-wise? How are they doing training-wise? How are they doing personally? And try to really develop that sort of culture. And lastly, just continuing to convey the importance of everything they do every day and asking the American people to understand it. We're not there to hassle the American people at the border. We're there to protect them. How do we galvanize them and get them thinking about that every day and knowing that they have, you know, thousands of people and shipments to deal with? And so that's a real focus of ours, is engaging culture of leadership, reaching out to our frontline personnel, and ensuring that we understand how important they are and supporting them in what they do every day.
And I assume with any law enforcement agency, integrity is at its soul. To what end, what are you doing to sustain or implement a culture of integrity?
First, we need to ensure that the people we bring in on the very front end, the people that we hire, are of the highest character and moral fiber. They're fit for the public trust that we're placing in them. Secondly, we need to engage in prevention efforts by continuing to drive a culture of integrity. And third, we need to be able to detect and then swiftly address corruption in our ranks in conjunction with our investigative partners, our Office of Internal Affairs, Office of Inspector General, the ICE Office of Professional Responsibility, and of course, the Federal Bureau of Investigation and their Border Corruption Task Force, which has a critical role. So on that first point, we've made a lot of progress as an organization at CBP. The Office of Internal Affairs has really worked aggressively to improve the background process. And now, 3 months ahead of the schedule set forth in the Anti-Corruption Act, we are administering polygraph examinations to over 100% of all CBP law enforcement applications. And that's a very new area for us, and we think is really going to help us on the front end in protecting the integrity of the folks that are joining us in the first place. On the prevention side, for field operations part, We've established integrity officers in each field office that go out to the front line and engage in training, engage in outreach with our managers and our first line personnel. And I'm gratified that the last two significant arrests of frontline CBP officers were actually detected by the Office of Field Operations, by our folks looking at our systems and trying to make sure that we had the most integrity possible.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection? We will ask Kevin McAleenan, Acting Assistant Commissioner of Field Operations for CBP, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.